So we're probably going to end with
the end. We'll discuss what we'll do in the future.
Just to put it in context, the Rav in the last chapter takes personal and communal responsibility to some degree for failure in the past, in terms of the Holocaust, of responding appropriately, right? Showing adequate concern for the broader community and saying, in essence, we're given a second chance. You don't always get second chances in life. Yeah? But here we're given a second chance. Right? We're given a second chance. Not to undo the past. You can't undo the past. But it helped Israel when the Jews are being threatened now. You know, whatever happens, happens. But what's good now? But in this chapter, the Rav is going to deal with not what wasn't done, but what are the opportunities, right? What uniquely does the religious Zionist community have to contribute to the future beyond that which everybody has, you know, any Jew has to contribute? So one would expect, and of course find out, that once the Rav had made this distinction between the Bris Mitzrayim, Bris Sinai, between the, right, the covenant of faith and the covenant of destiny, he'll say, okay, Israel is a solution, the covenant of faith. But if it's run by a secular people, so obviously it can't have anything to say of the covenant of destiny. Right? Because it's not talking about it's people who don't believe in religion. They don't believe in the destiny. So, and of course he's going to say that. But what is, I think, more significant is what he says are the mistakes in dealing with the covenant of faith of secular Zionism, which, and I am always loath to say what the Rav would have said, because it's the easiest thing in the world to say what anybody would have said, because he's not alive to contradict me. But some of these things have been adopted by the religious Zionist community itself, the things that the Rav complains about in the secular Zionists. And in the history of Zionism as a movement, I'm not talking about individual Jews going to Israel, I'm not talking about going back to the students of the Gra, the students of the Baal Shem Tov, or going back to Aliyah of the Ramban. I'm talking about Zionism as a movement, which we associate with Herzl a little bit before, with Kol Beit Zion, right? It was a movement that emerged in the period of time of nationalism, right? Of nationalism. And there's a famous work by a man by the name of Pinsker, which he talks about the problem is that the Jews are not a natural people, right? Nationalism, everybody has their own, a nation has a country. What kind of nation doesn't have a country? A nation is mixed all over the world. So we're not, so people don't know how to deal with us because we don't fit the normal pattern. So we'll have a country, we'll be a normal nation. So we'll have other people not liking us, but we won't have the anti-Semitism we have now. Right? And that was very much part of the Zionist vision. Right? The Zionist vision was we'll have our own state, we'll be a normal people, and that will, if not fully solved, would certainly tone down dramatically anti-Semitism. Right. Now, of course, this is not 1956, it's 2023. I don't think anybody today would say that anymore. Right? Hasn't happened. What has happened is that some anti-Semitism, has turned into anti Zionist, anti-Israel. Right? So it didn't solve, but I would take it one step further. With, you know, if you look at anti-Semitism in the world today, there is the traditional anti-Semitism, which hasn't disappeared, and the new version of anti-Semitism, which talks about ammonia against the Israel. Right? So it created new kinds of anti-Semitism, without solving the old one. Right? And the Rav predicts this. And he doesn't claim to be a Navi, he just says it's his analysis. All right, so we start chapter 11. All right. What should the relationship between Zion to its secular counterpart? You can see the political secular Zionism failed by virtue of one basic error. It's based on a false assumption that was introduced to the conflict of Egypt, conflict of faith. Secular Zionism asserts with the founding of the state Israel become a people like other peoples, and the force of Am Levadad Yishkon, go alone, is diminished. All right, you talk about the extremist, the a very important idea in much of Zionism. Now, obviously, everything is a broad statement, and you can find specific examples to contradict it, right? But in the broad sense, part of Zionism was called Shtilat HaGola, right? Denigration of the exile. Saying, you know, and coming with that with the notion of the new Jew, right? The image of the old Jew is the Jew during the Second World War, cowering and, you know, and being like sheep into the slaughter, and the new Jew, the Sabra with his gun, fights for Jewish rights, stand up to everything. We're not like that. And if you follow Israeli media, even today, you'll find someone using it in an argument. That's a Gullus mentality, right? That's for the old Jews. We have a different mentality. And there's extreme nation is to separate Israel from the Jewry of the world. That's an extreme. Most Israelis don't think that way. They feel some level of responsibility for Jewry in the rest of the world, but they're bewildered why every single Jew doesn't pick up now. Not wait till tomorrow and go on the next plane. But that's the solution to all problems. I'm not discussing religious value of living in Israel. I'm talking about the solution to the problem of the Jewish anti-Semitism. If we'd all be in Israel, we wouldn't have a problem. This train of thought is not only philosophically and historically erroneous, it's mistaken practically, adhering to the notion of equality with all peoples and union with all. Present the state of Israel have on many occasions been naive, they misunderstood things, all right? It wants to eliminate both the feeling of isolation and the phenomenon of shared suffering from the history books, right? Now, the state of Israel will not be able to abrogate the covenant that I will take unto you as a people, put an end to the shared faith, the source of Jewish aloneness. Right? The state of Israel is as isolated today as the community of Israel has been in the thousands of years of existence. It could even be more, because it's now in political. Right? And he's also talking to the notion of we should be a normal people. Right? We have to be like everybody else. There was the statement associated with Ben-Gurion, I have no idea, all these statements associated with people were not necessarily ever said by the person they're associated with, but the idea was said by someone, right? That when we're going to have Jewish criminals, right? Then we'll know we're a normal state. That's going to be a good thing, right? Because now we're not, you know, these holy, holy Jews were people. People have all kinds of people. Right? In a more positive sense, I remember the first time my parents went to Israel and they saw, you know, an Orthodox Jew wearing a yarmulke on his head, being a carpenter, building a building. That was, right? We're doing all the normal things that people do, right? We're not all, peddlers, we do normal things like everybody else. Now, to be fair, and this is not in the round, everyone had some notion we're going to be a special people, right? In the statement of the World's Artists Congress, called the Jerusalem Statement, that you have to sign technically to be count as a Zionist, and I was once involved in modifying that statement, but then I can't spend time on. It says, you know, Am LeMofet. Right? People who are, you know, high-level people, stars, right? We'd like to believe, yeah, we'll be like everybody else, but we'll be better than everybody else. Not just like everybody else. But if you wanted to pin down how we're supposed to be better than everybody else, so if they were socialists, they said we'd be better socialists. To a capitalist, they said we better capitalists, right? You know, we're going to be more moral. But how does that get expressed, right? Couldn't be pinned down. No one wants to think that we're just like everybody else. We have to be better. But how do we express that being better in specific Jewish terms, right? That has never been worked out. It's still there in the statement. I don't know, le mot faith, but it's such a vague term, it can mean what anybody wants it to mean. Literally anything anybody wants it to mean. All right? So the Rav says explicitly, the assumption that the State of Israel has weakened anti-Semitism erroneous. On the contrary, anti-Semitism has grown stronger. All right? Now, the Rav is tying it into a distinction that he made between the covenant of fate and the covenant of destiny. Right? We don't control fate. We control destiny. Destiny we have a notion of free will. Fate is what our fate is. Right? So if we're talking about the covenant of fate, so it can't be changed by anything we do if it's fate. Right? It is what it is. Destiny is under our control, right? That's why the notion of free will is so important. But if we're talking on the level of the covenant of fate, so then, we're stuck with our fate. We can respond to our fate, right? That's sheer responsibility. We care for each other. We try to help each other. But we can't eliminate our fate, right? Doesn't go away. Okay. All right. So then, what does religious Zionism have to offer? Because we have the double covenant, the fate of destiny, right? Destiny is free will, it's commitment, it's standing for something. But of course, it's a religious goal. Now, in this area, and I probably do not have time to discuss it unless we have an extra session, which would not really be based on the text anymore, there are two major rabbinic figures, even though they overlap only for a while, that dominate the religious Zionist world in the 20th century. And that's Rav Kook and the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. And to the Israelis, Rav Kook is the Rav. Right? And they're both identified with religious Zionism, even though they have a unique vision of religious Zionism. For example, Rav Kook never joined Mizrahi. Right, even though he's they follow Rav Kook, never was a member. The Rav did join Mizrahi, but the Rav had his own version of religious Zionism. And one of the fundamental differences between the two, which wasn't so relevant then, but of course it's extremely relevant now, is to the Rav's religious Zionism sees the state as a positive, as an opportunity, the Knox, right? But not as something intrinsically holy. It It's not our religious goal to have a state. We have to have a state. It's not opposed to having a state, and we support the state in every way we can, but it doesn't have kedusha. Right? It's a way of accomplishing goals. Now, to Rav Kook, the state is holy. And the way Rav Kook deals with the state being founded by secular people, or at least as his followers understand him and his son, because Rav Kook gives different explanations in different places, and being a mystic, it's easy to interpret him in different ways. It's poetic, it's mystical, maybe this way, maybe it goes that way, is that the state has kedusha, that the secular Zionist pioneers are religious, they just don't know it, right? Which of course helps in a religious vision, sometimes gets people really annoyed, because if I go to people and say, you think you are X, but I'm telling you what you really are, not everybody reacts well to that, right? You're telling me who I am? You know, I know who I am. In any event, it's very much part of the religious Zionist ethos. So, and believe it or not, it has an opposite effect than one would imagine. One would imagine that people who follow the religious Zionism of the Rav are going to say, I don't have to always follow the state doesn't follow halacha because it's not such a religious place. But within halacha, there's secular authority, the Malchus, Dina de Malchus Adina, has a role in the state. In the religious Zionist world, which the state has kedusha, if the state doesn't act properly, then it's a much bigger problem, paradoxically. Something that has kedusha should act with kedusha. Certain things they can't do if it has kedusha. So you have elements within the religious Zionist world who can be almost anti-Zionist, even though from religious Zionism, the state's not acting the way we want it to act, it's supposed to act. And it, that's part of a broader picture to this, where how things have developed in different ways. Where there's simply a difference in mentality with the bulk of American, or I'd say Western, or Anglo, the term they like to use in Israel, of Anglo religious Zionists, with exceptions, and the Israeli religious Zionists. And all of you who studied in Israel, if you studied not in American schools in Israel, which is not really studying in that sense in Israel, you know, certain mentality, but if you studied in an Israeli place, some of this will come through. Some of this difference in fundamental mentality and how the state is viewed, how the relationship is used outside of Israel and Israel. The things that they reference come through one way or another in the conversation. So what we have to offer, we have to raise it from Bris Mitzrayim to Bris Dina. What the Rav doesn't do is give you a prescription how to do it. Right? And of course, that's the great question always. Oh, this is the goal, that's great. How do I get there? What do I do? So that's not found in this particular Enkodo Dito place. Certain things come through from the Rav's other writings, and we now have many more writings of the Rav. Again, remember, all this was written said in 1956. The Rav's reaction to 67 is very important, right? On one hand, the Rav saw real Yad Hashem because you get prophecies being fulfilled. On the other hand, the Rav was very concerned about Messianism, and people seeing everything in Messianic terms. A whole discussion in its own right, but not predicted by if he wrote in 1956 or 1962, before the Six-Day Rule. From things that I know, the Rav was very much committed to the notion of education as being the way to accomplish the goal. Education more, but not fully replacing legislation. Remember, the Rav had a whole section about conversion, and my conversion involving accepting mitzvahs, right? And who is a Jew? The important question, right? And to the Jew, there's a religious definition of who's a Jew, and you can't just do away with it. And that involves legislation, right? When you define who's a Jew to be for citizenship purposes, purpose in Israel. But essentially, the Rav was always an educator and favored education over legislation. He didn't support, we would say, religious coercive education. You're not going to make people Shomer Shabbos by forcing them. Right? And that's not a healthy thing to try. You're just going to create dissent. Of the various Rabbanim from Israel that said Shir in the Rav Shir when I was there, the one that the Rav praised the most was Rav Neria. Rav Neria was the founder of the movement of Yeshivot Bnei Akiva. Before Rav Neria, there were religious high schools, right? But they corresponded, they weren't yeshiva high schools. They were religious high schools. Right? I don't want to give examples so America can get anybody upset. Right? Right? It's a whole different notion. And then from the boys' schools came the Upanot, which were the women's equivalent. Since Rav Neria's impact was educational, that's the one the Rav praised the most. You're going to change the people by educating them. And that makes perfect sense, because that was the Rav's mentality in dealing with Jews in America as well. So you don't expect a person's, you know, mentality to shift that much, right? We have now an interview with the Rav in 1932, and he talks about, you know, in America you have to have schools where people will learn Torah and have secular studies. Talk about day school studies. He doesn't say Torah Mada, but he's talking about that. That's convenient, you know. You have to have, so education is going to be, is critical to the Rav's notion of how we're going to accomplish this goal. Now, clearly when the Rav wrote all these things, he could not anticipate the Russian Aliyah. The Russian Aliyah complicates everything. On one hand, it's perhaps the most miraculous of all. Right? 50 years under a communist state, did everything to eradicate anything Jewish, and now we have millions of people in Israel. But a significant number of them are not halachically Jewish. Because you eradicate Judaism, you're going to have obviously a tremendous intermarriage rate. And you're not even going to be able to prove who's Jewish. Right? Because it's the Russian definition on the passport that that you're Jewish, not anything halachic. And then you have the problem of what do we do with these, how do we deal with these hundreds of thousands of non-halachic Jews, but they are, but in the national sense, they certainly are Jewish. When people talk about the non-Jewish population in Israel, they're talking about the Arabs, right? Because they're not Jewish, they have no desire of being Jewish. How we deal with them is a very good question, you know? But we don't mean, normally, all the Russians who are not halachically Jewish. Right? They fight in the Israeli army. Right? They go to the Israeli schools. They see themselves as Jewish. They marry other people. They don't only marry other Russians, you know? Right? Now, I don't have anything with the Rav said about how we would respond to that. Would that affect his notion of Geirus? Because he wasn't, it came to place in the late 80s, the Rav wasn't well already, we don't have anything that he said. The situation became more complicated in many, many ways. Now, on one hand, the Rav definitely sees the rise, the hopeful rise, of Zionism as taking Israel to the next step, right? From only one of the covenants of faith, even though they didn't do a perfect job in that either, to rise to the one of covenants of destiny, which means creating a religious state, a religious environment. But at the same time, the Rav doesn't spell out a formula, and he's talking about educating people, and he doesn't see it in messianic terms, which means that his vision and the vision which now dominates the thinking of religious Zion in Israel is not the same. I could say that in stronger terms, but I'll leave it at that. It's not the same thing. Right? The Rav would never ever have supported a religious Zionism that accepted the new Jew anti-diaspora mentality from the secular Zionists that he opposed to when the secular Zionists expressed it. And there you can hear it from religious Zionists. We are the real pioneers, and we are the ones of the new Jew. Now, having said that, life is complex. And no one person, answers all the questions. And certainly people, after they pass away, don't do very well at answering any questions. But this work is very important. It's important enough that when my oldest grandson Israel was in high school, I'm not sure, but I think he's still taught in high school. Kol Odido Fake was taught in Israeli high school. He's on the Bagur. It was taught because it was coming from someone from the outside. And I'll end with something interesting. In the early 1960s, I think it's 1961, but don't quote me because you can look it up and I'm probably wrong. Something very interesting happened in YU. David Ben-Gurion spoke in Lamport Auditorium. And on the stage with David Ben-Gurion and with pictures was Soloveitchik and Dr. Belkin. Right? This was a watershed moment because it meant, on one hand, from the Israeli end, the recognition that Yeshiva University and its kind of religious Zionism is critical in America, important enough that the Prime Minister comes. And from the YU perspective, it says, we know that Ben-Gurion is a secular person, and we're honoring him. From Ben-Gurion until Yitzhak Rabin, every single Prime Minister of Israel came to speak in YU and usually had a private meeting with the Rabbi. Somewhere I got lost. Now you can answer me that Bibi Netanyahu spoke in YU twice. That is true. He spoke in YU twice during the time he was not Prime Minister. And he was an American election tour, and someone paid the money for him to lecture in YU. But he wasn't Prime Minister at the time. He didn't speak in YU as Israeli Prime Minister. That statement got lost somewhere. I can't tell you who's responsible for it, because I'm not sure. But this writing of Kol Odifek, the Rav's identification with Zionism, was taken seriously enough in Israel that the Prime Minister made it his business to speak in YU. I would argue that the Prime Minister should speak in YU. I don't think anyone's going to care that I think that, because I'll give you all the reasons why you're going to get any serious aliyah from America is going to come from people from YU, support from Israel comes from people from YU. But I can say whatever I want to say. It doesn't make any difference. Okay, my time is up. I thank you very much.